Here we go. So I am here with the lovely Sarah Hayter. This is the first face-to-face chat I have on my YouTube channel, and I specifically asked Sarah to come as my first guest because I truly think that some of the needed reform in Islam is going to have to come from people from within, and perhaps from women from within. So perhaps we could begin by you telling us a bit about yourself, your background, your personal history, and then, of course, about the infamous or famous American Humanist address, and then we can take it from there.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I'm really honored to be the first guest. A little bit about me, I guess. I grew up in Houston, Texas, but I was born in Pakistan. And I grew up in a Shia community, pretty close-knit Shia community in Houston, Texas. I was lucky enough, though, that my parents were pretty liberal. So I didn't maybe question religion as much as others would have because it didn't personally affect me, and I wasn't forced to wear a hijab, for example.
Right.
But I did see that there were like my cousins, my family members, who were harmed by religion directly. So I was around that. I just wasn't affected personally. And I guess the most interesting part of my story, for the most part, it's the same atheism story where you start to read the text for the first time, you read the Quran for the first time, and it doesn't make much sense. It doesn't really sound very holy. You don't really see what's so sacred and wonderful about it. When with the Quran, you're told that it's the most beautiful text,
It's
you know,
so
in existence.
poetic
It's
that
so
only God
poetic.
could have written it.
Right, it's so, and I remember once reading, oh, this is so poetic, and then no, it really just doesn't feel that poetic. But maybe it's me. Maybe I just don't understand poetry well enough. Well, in any case, the first time, I can't pinpoint the exact first moment, but I know that what's interesting maybe about my story that didn't happen to others, which affected the way I do my activism, is that I started to encounter some militant atheists. Right, when I was still believing, but kind of starting to doubt. And around this time, some of my close friends decided they were going to be atheists. And the first, when you first leave religion, you become very ragey and aggressive. And so this was happening to my friends, and they started being aggressive towards me. Like they would print out things from the Quran that, these verses that were just horrific, right? And this was my first time being exposed to these things. I was like, no, Islam is wonderful to women, and because that's what you're told.
Yes.
And I mean, I remember being incredibly offended, right? I was offended. But that is what got me to look into it because I was so intent on proving these people wrong. I
Right.
was like, they're wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. And then when I started looking into it and reading into it, I was like, oh, I'm wrong. And it was very clear too. It really doesn't take much reading into it. Take a couple of weeks, maybe a few months, and you're out. So
So, I'm
that
sorry,
was
go
my
ahead.
story.
So, is your feeling that in many cases, Muslims might be in a situation where they are actually ignorant of the details or the contents of what's in the Quran? Or is it that in most instances they are aware of it, but they find a way to somehow integrate it within their moral compass, which of course might come from outside religion? What's your feeling about sort of those two possibilities?
Well, it's definitely both, but I think there's more of the first, the
Right.
former. There's definitely a lot of people who don't know anything about
Right.
Islam, and the way that they practice it. It's funny because it's just a reflection of their own moral values,
Right.
to some extent. But also, and you can't get away from it, that there are things in the Quran that, especially about modesty, that are so deeply intertwined into the faith that you can try and move away from it as much as you
Right.
can, but you're gonna fail, And at some point, I'll have Muslim friends that I know who will say, "Well, I don't wear the hijab, but that's because I'm weak," and
Right.
It's still valued. It's still prized. There are
Right.
certain things that you just can't walk away from, even if you try and reflect it as much as you can with your own personal moral code. So to that extent, I think that this is why I have sometimes I have a bit of a problem with progressive Muslims,
Right.
because I want them to say, this is the text, this is the verse, and it's wrong. but a lot of them can't do that.
Which leads me, I don't know if you saw my, if I look, I'm just trying to make sure that it's taping. Okay, it is. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to look at my latest Sad Truth clip. I addressed Majid Nawaz's efforts. Have you had a chance to look at it at all? If not, I'll just kind of
I have
summarize.
not. I have not.
So basically, as you know, Majid has a book that's forthcoming with Sam Harris, which I haven't read yet, but I'm certainly familiar with some of Majid's positions. And you know, in my clip, I was very open about being, you know, very, I admire his courage. I applaud the fact that he is trying to help the discourse. And so in that sense, I was very complimentary. On the other hand, so, sort of to pick up on your point of how some of these Muslims find all sorts of mental gymnastics ways to, you know, argue away some of the problematic passages, I thought that Majid was doing exactly that. So, for example, when you ask him if Islam is a religion of peace or war, while his views seem to have changed quite a bit from, say, a few years ago, where he's a lot more nuanced, he still will argue from a postmodernist perspective of, you know, it is whatever you want to make from the text of the text, blah blah blah. So, and here some people were upset that I drew a comparison to Reza Aslan. I wasn't arguing that the motives of Majid were in any way similar to those of Reza, but the fact that they were both using a postmodernist bent to me seemed illogical. And I'll just give you one quick example, and then maybe you could comment on the whole point I'm making. So I saw him on a recent show in Canada. It's called The Agenda with Steve Paikin, quite a popular show, where he was talking about the hadith that says, you know, if you change your religion, you know, kill him. And then he says, well, you know, the hadith doesn't specifically say if you change out of Islam. It's a general hadith, so it could apply to anybody, anywhere. And because of this sort of lack of clarity, then we could sort of reinterpret it using the peaceful passages from the Quran, which incidentally he doesn't say those have been abrogated by later more violent passages. And so my thinking was that I appreciate his efforts, but I'm not sure that we're going to truly reform Islam if we play these sort of mental gymnastics game. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that the overall postmodernist interpretation is harmful because I think these people are speaking only for themselves. You know, it may be possible that Reza Aslan is able to do that. He's able to, you know, look into religion and see only, you know, a reflection of himself. But there are so many who are not.
Right.
There are so many who are taking it very literally as an actual revealed truth. So I want, you know, these people to go out and say, this is not literally the truth. This is not literally the revealed truth, you know, and push that understanding, and maybe we'll get to this point where there are people who are only seeing a reflection of themselves. But that's not just not the case. That's just not what's happening right now.
Right. Now, if they do that, is the
If it's
next,
possible,
if
if
it's
it's possible, and they're doing that, then maybe things can get better.
But does that
But
mean that
I'm
they, I'm sorry, go ahead. Go
sorry.
ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, does that mean that they, then the next logical step is that they lose their faith and become ex-Muslims and join your organization? Or is there a way for someone to actually read those texts, repudiate much of it, and yet still call themselves Muslim in the same way that I call myself a Jewish atheist, right? So I am Jewish because Judaism incorporates many, many facets, a shared history, shared genes, shared, you know, ethnicity, but I don't necessarily believe in the religious narrative. So I can call myself a non-believer, but who yet belongs to a very distinct group of people. So could something similar happen with Muslims if they awaken to some of the contents, or that's the challenge. It's almost impossible to do so.
Well, I mean, I'm of the opinion, like, even though you're you know, sitting in front of me, saying you're a Jewish atheist, I don't know to the extent that that's something that most people will be able to accept.
Right.
And for most people, an identity means something, like something more, especially with something like Islam, where they say it's literally the perfect text, you know, and there's not really, it's not as, I guess, there's not a history of a certain ethnicity or whatever, of certain people being associated with a religion. It's considered a universal religion, and it crosses all these cultures, crosses all these boundaries. I just don't think that that's the best way to go about it. I actually think we need to move straight to atheism.
Wow.
I mean, I know that
Bold step.
that's intense. I know that that's intense, but I think that I actually think that's easier. I think it's easier to do for most Muslims to just give up the identity altogether. And then that I may be wrong when I say that, but I think that that's totally possible. And I think to some extent there are many countries or many cultures that have been sort of taken over by Islam, and their own cultural histories have been erased, right? And South Asia is a great example of this,
Right.
because you can compare India and Pakistan side by side,
Right.
and you can see that they, you know,
Same people, different
this is the same
religion.
people. They're
Yeah.
the same people, different religion, and they had the same culture. They shared the same values, and how much that has changed,
Right.
right? And how much you can see just religion's effect on that very clearly. And I think that's a very unfortunate thing. So I talk to people who are Pakistanis, and I say, you know, look at the beauty of the culture that has been erased, and the harms which would have gone away over time but never did, because they were also reinforced to some extent by religion.
Right.
You know, the music, the dancing, the clothes. I mean, it all became a little bit more Islamic, and everything changed. And I want people to feel sorrowful that that happened.
Right.
You know, that those histories are being erased. I want people to feel that way, and I think maybe come back to that identity, and maybe that's a step forward in a way that maybe a Muslim atheist identity isn't. So that's my opinion now. I mean, it may change in the future, but that's how I'm feeling currently.
I don't know if you know that at one point, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, another native informant. By the way, are you familiar with my Aslan Uyghur Decoder 5000?
Yes,
So
totally fair.
I entered that I would be having a chat with you, and it returned a meeting of the Nazi Party. So interestingly, it turns out that we're both Nazis, although you're also, of course, a native informant. But Ayaan Hirsi Ali took at one point, I don't know if she's altered her views, but she took at one point a slightly more gentle approach. Gentle in the sense that you're sort of going, let's all move to atheism, which is kind of a big step. At one point, she was arguing that maybe a lot of Muslims who may wish to leave the religion but are still craving sort of a monotheistic itch can switch into another religion, which, of course, in a monotheistic Abrahamic context, it leaves two other religions. What are your views on that? Is that a possible strategy or doomed to fail?
I think that's absolutely doomed to fail. I mean,
Right.
all respect to her. I
Right.
just think, I'm sure there are people who do that, but they don't do it for the right reasons.
Right.
I want people to start thinking clearly, to
Right.
start having, you know, truly embracing certain concepts of how we engage now in modern society, and how we understand truth, and how we understand knowledge. And in order for that to be possible, you really have to give up religion altogether,
Right.
or at least its current incarnations. I mean, if it can just be this vague figurative thing, you know, these allegories that are not at all.
Nature is God, right?
If yeah, I'm I whatever. Okay, that's fine. You know, I'm okay with that. My problem is, you know, when there's a specific verse out there that says that you have to do this kind of harm to this kind of person if they do XYZ, you know, serve justice on earth in this way, or whatever verse that allows you to justify your hate today. That's the problem.
Right.
And I don't know if leaving Islam and, you know, joining Christianity is going to change that too much. I mean, I think it'll certainly, it might get better if you go to, you know, the current way that we practice Christianity in America. It might get a little bit better, but not necessarily. There, you
Gotcha.
know.
So how has your approach resonated with the people with whom you interact? I mean, I'm not asking you to give me sort of a success rate, but what's the general feel? I mean, what are some of the successes? What are some of the obstacles, and so on?
Well, I mean, I don't go out trying to convert people out of
Right.
religion. You know, that's not, I don't, I practice what I practice, and I believe what I believe, and I'm very outspoken about it. And I think that in itself changes minds, and sometimes people think that that's a form of proselytization if you're just vocal about
Right.
your disbelief at all, right? So if people say something, I'll say something.
Right.
And in my, I can't tell you about, you know, broader overall friends, because nowadays I spend most of my time with atheists. But my family, it took a long time, and different people, different things worked for different people. So, you know, my father, who is now an atheist,
Congratulations.
it's wonderful. now that he's an eight, it took almost a decade to make that happen. But for him, it was, sort of a philosophical thing, and of morality. And then we came then specifically to the religion, because a lot of people get really offended if you start immediately talking about the harms of Islam in particular, because they feel singled out. So, for those who feel sort of besieged, I'll start with a general critique of Islam, or of religion, excuse me, of a general critique of religion. And, let's apply this to everything, and sometimes that works. And I think that that's what worked. I mean, that's what worked with some of my family members. So.
And do you find that, are there any descriptors that you've identified that can predict, which types of folks are going to be receptive to your message versus not? So, for example, could it be which country they come from? Could it be that in Pakistan they're inherently more dogmatic about their Islamic identity than some other country in Southeast Asia, or some other descriptor? Have you noticed any such patterns, or it really varies from individual to individual?
I think it varies from individual to individual. I think you'll have that kind of critical thinking, independent person that can come from any background. And that's the kind of person that tends to, I think, leave religion and join an organization like mine, ex-Muslim North America. And we have people that come from, all over, originate from all over the world, have, ethnic backgrounds from all over the place.
You're a
And
bit
I think, well, the
you're becoming
largest.
echoing a bit. Is it something? Can you hear me well?
I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead. Continue. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so we have people from all sorts of backgrounds, and I just think there is a common, personality characteristic, I think. At least when leaving religion is so difficult, that the first people to do it are a certain kind of person. After that, once we reach a certain, minority or sizable minority, I think it'll be so much easier, and you have the kind of people who don't normally, I guess, poke into these kinds of things, don't normally reevaluate their own values and beliefs. You'll have more of those people coming in too, just because they see that there's a sizable amount of people that are doing this. Hey, let me give it a shot.
I mean,
So.
the reason I ask the question is because, so if you look at, say, the level of religiosity as a function of which generation an individual is in terms of his host country, you will often find, for example, in Britain, that the later generations are actually more extremist than their parents or their grandparents who first emigrated to, say, Britain. And so, in that, it was in that spirit that I was trying to see if there were any patterns that, if you like, we can use to predict how willing people are willing how willing are people to leave the cloak of religiosity. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of it from the perspective of a consumer psychologist, because oftentimes, I mean, that's exactly what, as a consumer psychologist, you're trying to do, right? What differentiates or discriminates between whether somebody is likely to vote for you or not? What are some of the attributes that can help us describe if you're going to be in the yes group or no group? And so, in that sense, I think it would be an interesting empirical question to gauge, what are the key predictors that would allow us to identify those who would be most receptive to your efforts versus those that are going to put up obstacles. So, in that sense, that's what I was asking.
Oh, that makes sense. And, I mean, I wish we had enough data to do it. I mean, there's so few ex-Muslims and so few that are willing to come forward and, join an organization like ours. And we sort of we have a screening process. We don't just let anyone in that wants to be in. We speak to the people ahead of time. We do it the best we can. I mean, there's no way to ensure safety, but we can try. And we do, and we develop. We have these protocols that we develop, and we try and enforce them the best we can. And that even that scares some people off, because we want you to divulge some personal information about yourself to us, so that we can understand if you are, really like, and what are your motives for joining something like this. And some people aren't even comfortable doing that because they're so afraid.
Now, are they usually afraid for sort of the most basal, survival reasons? I'm going to be killed as an apostate, or are they predominantly afraid to be ostracized from their community, their families, and so on? Of course, both can hold true, but what's your general feeling? How imminent is each danger in their minds?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it depends. It depends on the person. Sorry about the vague answer, but I think it depends on the person. There are quite a few, unfortunately, who are afraid
Physically,
of
they're going
like
to be harmed.
of physical danger.
Wow.
I wouldn't say that's a majority, but it's sizable minority, and that's and those people tend to sort of run away quicker,
Right.
in the sense that we'll tell them, we require that you do XYZ before you can join our organization. Sometimes they get afraid for that because they say, I don't even want that much revealed.
And
But
these are people
for
who are living in North America, right? They're not contacting you from Pakistan.
And they tend to be, people from more extremist ethnic groups, I guess. The Somali community, for example,
Yes.
is one that tends to be a lot more extreme to apostates and to people who sort of deviate. It's not so bad with Pakistanis, not so bad with Indians, not so bad with Bangladeshis, as it is with Somalis, I've found. So there is variation in terms of where maybe you're from
Any
and
insight as
how
to
that
why that would be?
translates.
Why would that be? Do you have any sense? Is it how close you are sort of to the Arabic roots? I mean, literally geographically, if not ideologically, or what can explain this phenomenon, if you know?
I mean, I can only guess,
Right.
and definitely something that I've noticed is that there's a romanticization of, Arab culture
Right.
and the religion in the communities that tend to be the most extreme.
Right.
And with Pakistanis, I mean, the religion is a big part of it, but there is an independent culture that existed before the religion came in, that exists now, and so you can sort of relate to both, and you can sort of hold those both identities a little bit easier than with some other countries,
Right.
I think.
Right, got you. All right, let's switch gears. What did you think of what Ben Carson recently said? What's your position on that? Is he an Islamophobe that should heed CARES? If for those of you who don't know who are watching, CARE is the civil rights group that helps all people who are marginalized. But of course, they go around accusing anybody of being an Islamophobe if they dare criticize Islam. So what's your view? Was it fair what he said, or was he being Islamophobic?
Remind me of exactly what he said.
Well, I think somebody had asked him, I don't remember the exact words, but somebody had asked him, would you support a Muslim individual becoming president of the United States? To which he responded, again, I'm paraphrasing, well, probably not. And then he sort of equivocates if that person were willing to live according to, every element of our constitution, then yes, but otherwise, no, I would not be comfortable. And then, of course, CARE jumped on that and said this guy should basically drop out of the race because he's saying things that are antithetical to the American Constitution. So, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, so there's two things that sort of occur to my mind. One is that to me is a legitimate concern. And actually, I have that with Christians as well.
Right.
I'll think this person, like I think that with Huckabee, for example, Mike Huckabee, and I think he's too religious.
Right.
And he's somebody who takes his religion very literally. And I don't want, to vote for that guy because I'm worried that he will allow that those religious beliefs to supersede that of the Constitution. If a Christian or a Muslim is able to say, and I think that they are able to hold the Constitution and the law of the land above their own personal beliefs, whatever they are, then I'm happy with them, being elected. But that depends on on how much I gauge that that's really possible for this person. And unfortunately, too many people, even in America, believe that their religious rights, should be a part of
Right.
the law of the land. And that's so scary as
Right.
somebody who knows what it's like when that starts to happen. As somebody who can, and we can just look, all we have to do is look at Muslim majority countries to see how quickly that spirals down and how scary that becomes, especially for women, especially for minorities. So, I mean, I get uncomfortable with very religious people running anyway, no matter who they are.
Well, and I would say, I mean, if I could add, as a Jewish person, Jewish atheist, I wouldn't feel comfortable having a Hasidic Jew with the full garb being a president or prime minister of Canada. Does that make me anti-Semitic? No, it basically says that if this person is exhibiting this level of religiosity, then maybe he's going to hold he or she's are is going to hold views that are antithetical to the secular liberal democracy that I wish to live in. So to me, it seems like it's perfectly reasonable. You know, unlike saying that somebody who's got a particular skin tone should not be fit, I mean, that's just pure bigotry, right? I mean, there's
Right.
absolutely no way that your skin color could, in any conceivable world view, be relevant to whether you can hold office or not. Your sexual orientation shouldn't matter. Your ethnic background, forgetting about ideology, should not matter. But if you say, I subscribe to ideology X as part of my identity, then everybody should be perfectly, it would be perfectly reasonable to say, well, I actually have a problem with ideology X or some of its tenets, and so I certainly wish to question you on it. So I'll tell you my position. I think that I don't think it was unreasonable what he said, and that doesn't make me Islamophobic. It makes me somebody who's got a brain.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we can determine that there is somebody who's running who is, you know, Muslim or Christian or whatever,
right.
And they have a track record of not taking their religious beliefs into account when you know, dealing with the law.
Right.
You know, maybe they were a judge or maybe they've run for public office before, and you've seen that there's an independence there, that they're able to
right.
they're able to separate that, especially when dealing with the public. Then I would be a lot more comfortable.
Right, right.
And if you know, but we know that that's not the case because we see the way, you know, a lot of the Christian, the extreme Christian
yes.
Candidates, what they do now, where they can't really separate those values,
right.
where a lot of them tend to reflect exactly their religious values or political values. So,
well, I see it, by the way, I see it in a completely different context in my scientific work, right? As an evolutionist, I get blowback from all sorts of detractors who hate evolutionary theory for all sorts of reasons. Now, one of the group of detractors will, of course, be people who are religious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to draw an analogy to what Ben Carson said, well, I mean, could you be the president of the American Biology Association and be a hardcore evolution denier as part of your faith? Well, that's going to be tough because your faith, in this case, conflicts with some of the central definition of that post you're going to hold. And so I think it's totally fair to have that conversation. And of course, the big label of Islamophobia is only meant to make people afraid to have the discussion as we're having now. But switching to a related issue of sort of the intrusion of religion into the public sphere, I don't know if you followed the recent case in Canada, so switching from the US to Canada, of the, I think she was Pakistani actually, so she hails from your ancestral lands, who refused to take off her face covering when taking the Canadian oath of citizenship. Are you familiar with this case?
I just heard of it. I vaguely know about it. I mean, maybe you can tell me. Is
yeah,
there,
so I'll tell
are
you
there
about
laws
it
that prohibit somebody from doing that in Canada?
So that's the judicial debate that's happening right now. So I think in the lower courts, she was forced to have to, you know, to remove her veil because you have to show your face and so on. And then she appealed to a higher court, and then she won because, of course, the judges were white, guilt-ridden, multicultural, PC social justice warriors who said, no, it's not fair. Our country's based on religious freedom. Now, I mean, think about it first. Now I think it's going to be appealed, if I'm not mistaken, to the Supreme Court. But I mean, think about it for a second, right? What is the signal it sends when somebody who you open the door to this person to come to this country, and at a minor concession where you say, for 15 minutes, I will shed the cloak, in this case literally, of my religion so that I can demonstrate that allegiance to secular values, and she says no. And in Arabic there's a term for that. It's called wuhane. Wuhane basically means, if you like, grandiose chutzpah, right? It's a really perfect Arabic word that captures exactly that mindset. And you see it, of course, in all sorts of other contexts where people who are used to having 100% of their ways accommodated from the countries that they come from then come to a pluralistic society, and they simply don't have, literally, the psychological tools to say, I will concede, right? I mean, a marriage is about concessions. A marriage is about negotiations. No relationship can work if we don't have that mechanism. And so, of course, I'm strongly against this woman's behavior. What are your thoughts? Do you agree? Do you disagree?
Well, up until recently, I wasn't really familiar with the case,
right,
or at least the details of the case. And this is a really, for me, it's very difficult because on the one hand, I'm a civil libertarian, so
right,
I'm very much about personal freedoms, and I think that's really important, and I want everyone to respect it. And so in that sort of scenario, I guess I would fall back to if there was, you know, a rule or a, you know, in the citizen ceremony of facial coverings at all, and sometimes there is, and I think a lot of there already is, that everyone else is abiding by. In that case, you should abide by it too, if it's a rule that everyone is abiding by. I'm not sure if that was the case with this Canadian
right,
case, and that sort of puts it in this fuzzy category. And I agree with you symbolically that that's exactly what I think it means too. I think it means a rejection of these values, and that's very troubling to me. And this is similar, I think, the way I feel about it is similar to how I would feel about, for example, putting the hijab on to young women, to young
yes,
girls, right? And there are some families who say, well, you're 9 or you're 10, you're about to go through puberty, now it's time to wear the hijab. On some level, I think it's almost child abuse, right? Because
yes,
because you are forcing this young woman to be visibly separated from society, and at that young of an age, she really can't consent. She really doesn't know the extent to which she is going to be visibly separated from society and how that will affect her. She doesn't know. She's going to say yes because mom and dad want her to say yes. She's going to say yes because she thinks it's the right thing to do or the good thing to do. She doesn't understand the ramifications of it. So sometimes, you know, people ask me, do you think the hijab should be banned? And then sometimes my instinct is to say, you know, well, not for adults, but maybe for children.
Right.
But then I think that how much from a lawmaking perspective, how dangerous is that? That
right,
we say that, you know, parents don't have certain rights over their children. And of course they don't have complete control over their children. There are certain things they cannot do. But if we start there, you know, if we start, they can't, you know, push their ideology on their children in any way. You know, where does that take us? Where does that go? Does that become a scary thing in the
right,
in the end? And does that give the state too much power, which is something I'm always worried about? So I kind of, it's one of those very
yeah,
difficult.
I'm also sort of two minds. Incidentally, going back to sort of my area here in Quebec, we recently had a big debate at the provincial level. Provincial is the equivalent of your states, right? And so in Quebec, we had a debate you know, whether any civil servant should be, you know, not allowed, should be disallowed from wearing of any conspicuous, you know, religious symbols. Now, it could apply to, of course, a Jewish kippah, it could apply to a massive cross, and of course it could apply to all of the various Islamic garb. Now, the reality, frankly, I think, is that it was very much, although it was couched in the language of, you know, we're against all religious, you know, attire, I think it was precisely because there was a fear of the increase of hijabs and niqabs and so on that you see all over Montreal. Now, you know, I'm, you know, I think that, as you said, I'm also a libertarian, and in that sense, I feel uncomfortable having the government say what you can or can't wear. But on the other hand, there are real pragmatic issues. Take, for example, the Abercrombie case that happened a few months ago in the U.S., right? And I wrote about it, and I made some media appearances about it. Well, I think it's completely ludicrous that somebody can come in and say, you are going to change the actual dress code of your company to suit my religious beliefs. That's not a governmental agency. A company is perfectly allowed to say, we only want to hire people who are good looking, who exhibit or exude sexuality. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what Abercrombie's positioning was for the longest of time, right? So for this woman to come in and then say, well, no, you now have to alter the company's image to suit my religious beliefs is outlandish. And so I think I would allow the wearing of the hijab in public as a free person, but you certainly can't impose it everywhere that you wish to impose it. What do you
and
think?
I agree with you there. I agree with you there. Especially, I mean, if you take that to the logical conclusion where it's like, can you be employed as a model if you're saying, well, I want to be a model, but I will wear this head covering all the time. And there are certain jobs where you really do, there is a dress code, there is a certain appearance, and people want you to follow it, and that makes sense. I don't think that's discrimination. I think that's just a job description.
I want to be a porn star, but my religion doesn't allow me to be nude, so I'd like you to pay me as a porn star, but I'll always keep my clothes on.
Exactly. I was just gonna say I was gonna just gonna say a strip club. I was gonna say, I mean, that's ridiculous. Of course not. This is a basic part of the job. And I agree with you with a company like Abercrombie, that is part of their image. That is what they're selling. But back to the hijab in public spaces, limiting it in public spaces becomes harmful for the women who are wearing a hijab, especially if they're young, especially if they're forced, because you then put them in a position where there are some families or some parents who will say, either wear it or you don't go out at all. And we know people that have joined our organization who have said that when we were talking about this, privately, they've said that is what would have happened to me. If suddenly I couldn't go to, a public library wearing a hijab, then I wouldn't be allowed to go to a library. Right? And so that is a reality of a lot of people. And maybe you're causing more harm than good when you're essentially just isolating those women who don't, maybe have too much control anyway of their, and some do, of course, some do and do, they're very proud and very out about how it's their choice. But I want those women also to acknowledge that there are a lot of women for whom it is not a choice. Just at least acknowledge that. Acknowledge that. And if it is your choice, good for you, wear it. But, acknowledge that it isn't for many.
Do you have a sense? I mean, I'm sure you haven't conducted the appropriate empirical study, but do you know of any studies or any data or even anecdotally in terms of what percentage of women you think are actually forced to wear the hijab versus come to that decision of their own volition?
It's hard to say because so many start young, and at least that's what happened in my family. I think it's a very different thing when women wear it at a certain age, when they're 25 and they decide they have it, reborn, whatever, and they become very Muslim and they decide to wear it. That could be measurable, but so many start young, very young, that I think that there's no way to judge for those women in particular. Who make up the sizable majority of hijab wearers or people who start off pretty young. I don't know if you can say that that was ever a choice.
I grew up in Lebanon. I was born in Lebanon, and I grew up there till the age of 11, and then we escaped Lebanon because, of course, we were running away from new atheists. That's a little humor interlude. But in Lebanon, at the time that I was growing up there in the 70s and 60s, you almost never saw any woman wearing any Islamic garb. As a matter of fact, it was very, very badly seen by everybody, Muslims, non-Muslims alike, to actually dress in this manner. And then, of course, as you know, if you look at photos from Afghanistan in two different time periods, or in Iran, and
Pakistan's the same.
Pakistan is the same. And so, I mean, it's quite hypocritical to sort of argue that there is no way to be to maintain your Muslim identity without donning these attires, because we've got all sorts of historical contexts where women weren't wearing it, even in the context of Montreal. I mean, the now, of course, this is mainly due to immigration, but if you compare the number of women who today walk around Montreal streets wearing all sorts of various Islamic garbs to 10 or 12 years ago, I mean, you absolutely never saw it then. And I would probably venture something like one out of every 10 women that you see on the streets today is wearing an Islamic garb. And so I wonder if there is a way to go back to the more secular, modern style of, I mean, what do you think would have to happen? Is it that you have to convince these women that they can still maintain their identities without having to consistently create this wall of separation with the other? What's the solution to this?
I mean, I think that's involved tied in with the rise of more fundamentalist literalist Islam overall, and I wonder what that has to do with people actually reading it. you know, the rise of literacy of the average population in these countries who are reading it and who can see for themselves that the most extremist people are more on the ball than maybe the more liberal ones. And also in on that same vein, there are people who are shedding their cultural backgrounds in favor of a more Islamic, you know, identity.
Right.
And you see that a lot in the West, which scares me.
Right.
You see that a lot where there's a concentrated effort to find out what was cultural, like say for in the Pakistani community, there may be in the mosques, there's an effort to look at what is an Islamic tradition or what's a Pakistani tradition. And if it's a Pakistani tradition, let's toss it and let's embrace whatever is the Islamic tradition. I mean, unless they don't contradict each other at all and they don't affect each other at all in any way. So there is this growth of like a universal global Muslim identity that I think is tied into this women wearing hijab all the time. Because, I mean, the way that they defined what being Muslim was had a lot to do with their local customs.
Right.
So, you know, the way women in Pakistan defined it. I mean, then there was the growth of there was a lot of Sufis in India and in Pakistan at a time. And that was, but now you can see that that's not, you can read the Quran for yourself. And you can see that that's not the truth. So I think things are changing, and that's very unfortunate. I don't know if there's a way to go back because we do have something that we're starting with. We do have this text, and unless you can say this text is not the complete truth or it's not a literal truth, you can't go anywhere. You know.
Well, of course, what guys like Majid and others who want to do the mental gymnastics will argue is that, well, any single sequence of words can be interpreted in a myriad of ways. And so whatever particular passage that you could find in the Quran or in the Hadith that says that women should be covered, there is a way to reinterpret that for it to mean, no, it doesn't mean covered. It means to take off your veil if you really understand Arabic. See, one of the disarming things about when people debate me is that a lot of the usual BS that they'll throw at people won't stick on me, right? So when somebody says, but you know, you don't speak Arabic, I go, but I do. Oh shit, okay, that's not good. Well, but you didn't grow up in the Middle East. No, but I did. And then of course, they find the dark secret. I'm a vile, evil Jew. That's the problem. So I think the idea is that, I think we go back to sort of one of the original points that we had. It's all about information, right? And that's why, I mean, people ask me, why do I mean, I'm very busy as a scientist. I've got enough stuff to keep me going on a typical day. I certainly don't need to do this, but I find it incumbent on me and on everybody else who has the ability to have a platform to participate in the debate reasonably, politely, without hatred, dispassionately, because it is a battle of ideas. And when I first was exposed to your work, as I think many people were in that brilliant speech, I thought, wow, what a courageous young woman. I'm sure she's going to take tons of flack, but she's out there, right? She's got, if I may say, now if the feminists will get upset at me, she's got testicular fortitude, right? She's standing out there with very big testicles, and she doesn't care what and I think if more people do that, and I know, by the way, that there are a lot of them who would like to be part of the discussion but are profoundly terrified. I could look no further than my academic colleagues. It's simply incredible how many of them are perfectly comfortable criticizing Christianity. As a matter of fact, to criticize Christianity makes you a progressive. It makes you enlightened. But the minute that I post anything that might be critical of Islam, oh boy, watch them hide. It's unbelievable. Right. I'll tell you one quick example and then I'll give you the floor again. And I discussed this in one of my recent YouTube clips. I put up a clip of a Iraqi astronomer who was basically arguing that no, the earth is absolutely flat because it says so in the Quran, blah, blah, blah. So I put this up. I didn't editorialize anything. I just put up the clip. A scientist, a fellow evolutionary scientist from California, wrote to me, I mean, publicly on the thread, to paraphrase her sentiment, she was saying, well, I mean, why are you putting this up? Why are you making fun of these marginalized people? Why are you doing this? So her instinct, her reflex, was not to say, how could a fellow scientist actually spew such nonsense? She was upset at me for pointing out his nonsense. And we need to kind of get past this obstacle. Otherwise, I think it's going to be a very, very nasty battle.
Right. I mean, and what bothers me about this is that you can have said, the Shahada, or, you can have called yourself a Muslim yesterday,
Right.
and you are now someone who can speak for Islam.
Right.
Meanwhile, if you are criticizing Islam, you have to be a scholar, you have to have a
Yes.
PhD, who
Yes.
speaks fluent Arabic, who is ethnically, like
Yes.
dark or brown, and all these things. I mean, and these politics of what makes an authentic critic
Right.
versus a non-authentic critic. I mean, and you'll find that there is no such thing as an authentic
Right.
critic of Islam.
Well, I'll tell you a great anecdote on exactly that point. So I've debated with Muslims and non-Muslims alike about various things. And so let's say I'll point to, do you know who Yusuf al-Qaradawi is? Do you know? Does
No.
that, so he is one of the preeminent Sunni Islamic scholars. I mean, he has about as clean a pedigree of an Islamic scholar as you can have. I mean, he's, I think, now in his 80s. He's the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think he originally comes from Al-Azhar University in Cairo. I mean, he's the man, okay? Guess when I quote something by him or by Al-Baghdadi, the so-called caliph of ISIS who has a PhD in Islamic studies. Guess what people will say about these two guys?
They're not real Muslims.
Exactly. I mean, right? Their friend Ahmad, who goes drinking with them and parties, and who's a very nice Muslim, that's the true Muslim. But
Right.
Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, or Caliph of ISIS with a PhD in Islamic studies, they just don't understand. They're fake Muslims.
And
So,
this is so destructive, right? Because
right.
these politics of you have to be deemed to be authentic,
Right.
and who is the one that's deciding who is or isn't
Right.
authentic, right? I mean, that there's a certain media type person, like elite. I don't want to say elite, that's a weird word, but there are a certain group of people who get to decide who is or isn't authentic, who does or doesn't count as, somebody who can speak for Islam, speak for Muslims, or speak against Islam and against Muslims. And it's a weird marriage between, and you've talked about this many times, about postmodernism and cultural relativism and moral relativism. So it's a strange marriage between postmodernism and the relativisms that go along with it,
Right.
and this desire to legitimately protect what they feel is an embattled, a besieged minority.
Right.
And it becomes a very toxic thing. And what I want to talk about, and what I have been talking about, is that it's harmful to Muslims. It's harmful to progress, because no one is allowed to speak about, the harms that they have. And it really is extremists who change the dialogue, right? So it is the people who will point out the worst in what is happening that gets people to pay attention to a trend overall, right?
Right.
So we have to give these voices some credibility. We have to be able to listen to them, and that includes both extremist Islamic, scholars. We have to look at them and say, there are people who are thinking like this,
Right.
and they have some legitimacy in the text. And we have to talk about that as a real thing, rather than just dismissing it, which is what's happening. It's just being dismissed.
Well, I think it's because the reality is that they can't provide counterpoints to something that you offer, and so they have to literally attack the messenger, right? I mean, the idea is the way you determine who is an authentic voice for Islam is whether the person who is speaking is saying things that we can test their veracity, right? I mean, that's in a reasonable debate, that's what determines whether what you're saying makes sense or not. So when Ben Affleck attacks Sam Harris, are you the guy who speaks for Muslims? I mean, nobody said that he's the guy who speaks for Muslims. But if he makes a verifiable point, which can either be proven to be false or true, then he's contributed to the debate. But if you don't have the capacity or are unwilling to navigate through the arguments, then you say, well, who are you, Sam Harris? You're some California white boy. How dare you, right? So I think that's the reason, right? It's you have to, if you like, behead figuratively the messenger, because if the message gets out, then you lose the debate, right? And
Right. And those are, so, I mean, they're dirty politics,
right.
right? And we've seen the way what Majid is being called, and he's a Muslim, right? And he's being called porch monkey, lapdog, all
And he
these
doesn't
things.
even he doesn't identify himself as an ex-Muslim, right? He identifies himself as somebody who is still within the faith, correct?
Right. He is a believer, as far as I know, and he identifies himself
right.
as a believer. And I mean, if he can't speak for Muslims, and he can't
with
can,
his
who
pedigree,
can?
Exactly.
What it means is that Islam stays the way it is.
Right.
Because we have this vision of what we feel Islam is in our minds, and that is the only, and people who are saying exactly that are the people that are going to be supported, and anyone that says anything else is not going to be supported. So
right.
what happens is that there's no progress, there's no change. You know, to some extent, you have to be able to look at, you know, what's happening in your own communities, the harm,
right.
to move forward. And Western communities can do that to their own, and that's why they can progress. And so you're kind of dooming, you know, you're kind of dooming these
Absolutely.
Muslim communities to just this place
Being
where they
static.
Can't move forward, right?
Exactly.
And it's quite tragic.
So maybe I'll ask you one more question, and then I know that you have to go. Thank you so much for your time. Then we'll end it maybe hopefully with you giving some hopeful last words. But one other big sort of issue that is on everybody's minds, sort of in the global geopolitics, is the issue of the influx of migrants from all over the place. What's your view on that? Do you think that it is racist and Islamophobic to be putting up walls at some point where you say to people, look, we can't bring in, 800,000 migrants to Germany or whatever the number is? Or do you think that it is part of sort of our global moral compass to take in people if they are in need? How do you navigate through this very difficult issue?
Well, that's a pretty big question. I don't know if I can.
I know I should be winding down the conversation. Meanwhile, I'm hitting you with the.
I think I could talk about that for a couple of hours. And, I don't know. But generally speaking, I think if a country is able, and if they are willing, then it is somewhat incumbent upon them to take in some refugees. But we are getting into this weird situation where there are tons and tons of refugees coming in, and I'm worried. What I'm worried about is that they're not going to be able to immerse fast enough.
Right.
And that is going to change the shape of the country in a bad way, because they're going to bring their, you know, Syrian values or Iraqi values or
right.
whatever it is, and they're not going to have time to, and it takes some time to absorb the values
yes.
around you, especially if you're coming into a very different culture.
Yes.
It takes some time, it takes some education, it takes some befriending the locals. But if you're going to put, and I think that this may be happening, I hope it isn't, I hope I'm wrong about this, that I hope the refugees are spread out in,
right.
in Germany, at least. I don't think that's the case. I think they're mostly being, you know,
because
put
you're
here
worried about
here.
The ghettoizing, right? Is that
right?
The, yeah.
I'm worried about that. I'm worried about that. And that is happening in the UK.
Yeah.
And I don't think I think that will cause a lot of problems in the long run, unless you take a lot of efforts to make sure that those people get immersed and it's as smooth as possible, that transition. And this whole concept of multiculturalism doesn't really help
yes.
in that regard, because it says that there's something there, that you're an evil person if you think that there is such a thing as a value that's worth pursuing for all of humankind,
right.
and everyone should embrace this value.
Who are we to judge that some cultures wish to cut off the clitorises of women? I mean, hey, you know, maybe in their culture that's a really nice thing.
Right, and it's so frustrating to have that conversation. But I think that kind of attitude really makes things worse, not better.
Right. Well, I think it's a reasonable answer to a very difficult situation. So now this is your opportunity to do two things: to end us, to infuse us with optimism as we move forward, your last words, and then if you have anything that you'd like to plug, maybe the website of your organization or anything else, your Twitter, please do so now.
Well, my organization, for those of you who don't know about it, those of you who are listening, it's Ex-Muslims of North America is my organization. And what we do is we build local communities for ex-Muslims across the U.S. and Canada, which is really helpful for people who are experiencing social isolation and who need support and who just need somebody to talk to who they can relate to. So we build communities and we advocate on behalf of ex-Muslims. We try and bring ex-Muslim issues to the forefront. Please go to our website. That's exmna.org. And if you can support us, if you can donate, all of that is wonderful. We're a 100% volunteer organization, so everything will just go to making sure that those programs are running.
Your Twitter account,
so
maybe, if they want to follow you?
My Twitter is Sarah the Hater.
Right.
like Sarah, my first name, Sarah, the Theaider.
Now, I'm assuming that's because Sarah Hader was taken, so you had to incorporate the article the in there, right? Not, it's not because you're narcissistic and you had to add that the as part of your title.
Well, it's I liked it because I've been using that handle for a while because I was, people would make fun of my last name. They would say it sounds a lot like hater, you
right.
know, so they would call me the hater. And
oh,
so I was
see.
Like, at some point I thought I'm going to embrace it.
Right.
And that's where that came in from.
In the way that I've embraced the Godfather.
Right. It just becomes, it's part of my identity now. That's who I am.
Right.
Well, I am, to end on a kind of a positive
yes.
note, I am hopeful, which is why I say that, you know, there doesn't need to be this in-between period of this whole we're reforming Islam. I think that there are a lot of people who, especially with what we talked about, sort of touched on a little bit, the advent of the internet and all this information being available to everyone, that is going to change things dramatically. And I think that people are going to deconvert so much faster. And it's particularly in Islam, I think it's a little bit easier to do when you're confronted with the information.
Yes.
Because it is so, so backwards in so many ways.
Right.
So it's easy to say, to take that leap altogether.
Yes.
In my opinion. And I have seen to some extent that ex-Muslims in the West who have changed, and I've seen the way that they have influenced their family even back home, right?
Right.
And so somebody converts out, leaves a religion, they start having Skype contact, calls with their family members back home.
Right.
And then they're sort of changing mind there. I don't know if there can be change from the, you know, top down.
Right.
But I am very optimistic that there can be a movement, sort of bottom-up movement. But we have to get to a point where there are a significant enough amount of atheists, you know, or disbelievers overall, who are able to talk about it. And I think that starts in the West, right?
Right.
That this is the first, you know, battleground. And then once we can really start having these open discussions, they're able to hear it, you know, in Muslim majority countries, and they're able to be affected by it.
What a wonderful way to end this fantastic discussion. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to end the recording, but stay, don't hang up. I'm going to be posting this on my YouTube channel at some point. I don't know how long it'll take me to upload a 1-hour discussion, but stay tuned. It should be up later today. Thank you so much, Sarah. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you for
Cheers.
Having me.
Bye.